from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Judy Campbell, in for Michael Krasny. As the former dean of freshmen at Stanford University, Julie Lithcott-Hames, had to deal with the consequences of parenting, both good and bad. Drawing on the latest research and her own experience as a mother, Lithcott-Hames paints a picture of modern parents as overprotecting, overdirecting, and hand-holding, leaving colleges with kids who are unable to fend for themselves. Lithcott-Hames joins us to discuss her new book, How to Raise an Adult. That's next on Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell. Julie Lithcott-Hames was Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University for a decade until several years ago. In that time, she saw that students were coming in with increasingly impressive accomplishments, every class with higher grades, test scores, and longer resumes. And yet, she writes, she began to worry that they were, quote, somehow not quite fully formed as humans. They seemed to be scanning the sidelines for mom or dad, under-constructed, existentially impotent. These kids of the so-called helicopter parents had arrived at college, and with her front row seat as dean of freshmen, she became increasingly concerned about the way middle and upper-class parents, including herself, have been raising their children. Julie Lithcott-Hames joins us to discuss her new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kids for Success. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Judy. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So why don't you explain what you mean by these kids not being fully formed? What were you seeing?
Well, as a dean on my campus at Stanford, and I'll add, based on conversations I was having with administrators all over the nation, in every tier, in every geographical region, I was noticing that more and more students were coming to college with their parents, often not literally, but terribly virtually. Parents were wanting to play a role in the life of their son or daughter and in the life of the university. And at the same time, students seemed grateful for their involvement and not terribly hungry to do and be and think and choose and resolve and solve for themselves. And I guess that's, in a nutshell, what made me worry that something was off.
You say not necessarily literally, but there was also literally, right? You saw a lot of physical presence of parents. So.
Absolutely. You know, parents these days come to campus and really want to stay for a while and make sure everything's all right. And look, I understand. I'm a parent myself. Let me say that right away. I have two teenagers at home. We love our kids fiercely. But I think when it's time for a son or daughter, and I don't like to say child when they're 18, when it's time for a son or daughter to go to college, we really need to know that they've got what it takes to conduct themselves in that environment and do for themselves. And we'll always be there to provide advice and guidance on the phone, but we really need to step back and let them be in the forefront of their lives.
And what are those skills that you're seeing that they don't have?
Well, I think children today lead what I call a checklisted childhood. And when I say children today, I mean middle and upper middle class children whose parents have disposable time and income to spend devoted to the lives of their offspring. Kids are leading a checklisted childhood. This means everything is very deliberately and carefully planned. The schools, the activities, the enrichment, the coaching, the tutoring, the handling, and so on. And when a kid has led, you know, a childhood according to someone else's path, where sort of the path has been smoothed and planned, they emerge out into the wide open world of adulthood where there is no longer a checklist, where the landscape of opportunity is vast, and they're bewildered because they're used to someone else sort of being there to nudge them along. So an ability to think for themselves, you know, to make a choice, an ability to cope with disappointment or uncertainty. You know, their first impulse, almost as naturally as to take a breath of air, is to text a mom or dad or to post on Facebook seeking help from the community instead of to turn within and to say, you know, what do I think I should do? And it's that skill that we, you know, need them to have.
So critical thinking, kind of making, getting themselves out of trouble, they're just, I mean, you paint a picture of kids who are pretty helpless in a lot of ways. There's one story in your book about a kid who arrives at Stanford and his boxes are on the sidewalk and he doesn't know how to ask somebody for help. It's a two-person job, doesn't know how to ask somebody for help. And so he calls his mother, who calls, I guess, the residential, the dorm resident who, you know, then comes down.
Exactly.
That's a pretty roundabout way to ask for help.
It is. And, you know, you got to feel sorry for a kid who's had everything done for them such that they arrive at that point bewildered on a sidewalk, not having a clue about how to seek assistance in the world as opposed to from a parent. You know, I think this gets at a key question, Judy, which is, when do we let them talk to strangers? There's so much in our minds and hearts as parents around fear of strangers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the statistics about the rates of stranger abduction are infinitesimally small, and yet we act as if it could happen any time. And we've taught our kids never to talk to strangers. And the inevitable outcome of that is they will lack the skill to talk to a stranger when they need a stranger. We've, you know, this is a classic example of where our job is to prepare our kids for what's out there, not to protect all the time and try to prevent every outcome. We need our kids to actually be able to discern the very small number of scary strangers from the vast number of wonderful ones.
So for you, this all starts really early.
It does.
And it's about kind of opening up a kid's childhood from an early time. So what do you think? What are the ages we should be looking at? When should kids be walking alone? When should they be talking to strangers?
You know, we first of all got to take the long view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job and raise our kids to self-actualized independence. Okay. I think number one, we have to know that and really get that. And then we have to act accordingly. Okay. So if you take that long view, if you really believe it, if you really get the fact that we won't be there forever for them, and therefore, if they're dependent upon us, it's a crutch. If you appreciate that, then you realize that really from the minute they can walk, you know, from the minute they're no longer in our arms, no longer being spoon-fed, we're meant to be, or breastfed, we're meant to be teaching them how to do for themselves. And it's not neglect to let them walk alone. Mm-hmm. We must let them walk alone. At some point, we stop holding their hand. We stop walking alongside them. So, you know, I can't answer here. I live in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And what's right for me and my kids in Palo Alto is going to be different for a listener, you know, someplace else. But it's know your kid, know your community, and remember, your job mm-hmm. is to prepare them.
And yet, people get arrested for this stuff, right?
Which is crazy,
mm-hmm.
and which represents an encroachment of government in the form of the police and Child Protective Services into the individual choice-making of parents. Ironically, this may be the only issue on which conservatives and liberals can agree in our nation right now. You know, when did the potential harm that might come to a child walking on a sunny sidewalk become a crime a parent can get arrested for? I mean, what's happened to the Métis in Maryland is atrocious.
Yeah, well, explain that. There was parents who let their kids walk. How old were the kids?
I believe the kids were 10 and 6,
uh-huh.
and they were allowed to walk from the home to the nearby park, to the nearby 7-Eleven, and back again. They'd prepared their kids for this. They'd walked with their kids. And then they said, you know, you're ready to, yes, you can do this on your own, with the 10-year-old watching the 6-year-old. And a well-meaning, and if you could see me right now, I'd be making air quotes, a well-meaning person made a phone call to say there are kids alone on a sidewalk, and the police came. And this family was subjected to months of harrowing intrusion into their choice making. The labels they were branded with around being neglectful were horrifying. And, you know, these poor kids were made to feel that their parents had made a bad judgment on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the second time they were picked up, the police held the kids for hours without letting the kids talk to the parents and without letting the parents know where the kids had gone. So, you know, there's just this issue alone deserves reexamination. It's one small element of what I write in the book. It's the overprotection mentality that says our kids are unsafe at all times and they're only safe, therefore, if there's an adult.
Well, and it also brings up the issue, though, that it's a little bit of a risky thing to go against that, right? I mean, people are looking at you. They're judging. Parents have expectations. Neighbors have expectations of how people you're really asking people to kind of turn away from the status quo and sort of being a little more hands off with their children.
I'm saying be a little bit hands-off, but I'm also saying band together and form community with those who are like-minded. I believe it's sociologist Markella Rutherford who has written about the lack of community in neighborhoods or the lack of neighborhood in society, which means, you know, we don't know our neighbors. We're not familiar with one another. We don't rely on each other the way we used to when you and I were growing up. So there's this tremendous sense that it's entirely on me, the individual parent, to look after my child instead of this sense that, you know, they're all eyes. In a careful, loving, watchful way on my children. So I think the answer is, you know, to talk to law enforcement, to talk to schools. I mean, what do you do in a community where a school policy is a third grader can walk to school and back home again alone, but the police feel differently? You know, we've got to be on the same page, and we've got to keep in mind this long-term goal. Our kid needs to walk alone someday. They don't magically acquire that skill when they turn 18. Childhood is meant to prepare the way. It's our obligation to teach.
Well, it's interesting what you were just saying, too, about, you know, that it all falls on you, the parents. Because another thing you talk about in this book is that parents seem to have less of a trust in the institutions, checking and not trusting that the schools that they leave their kids with are doing the right thing, kind of thinking that they have more information about what's good for their kids than the professionals do.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is an example of an illustration of the way the baby boom has shown up in the role of parent. The first set of parents to helicopter parent en masse were members of the baby boom. And, you know, this is a generation that questioned authority as teenagers and young adults, demanded great change in the systems and mores of this nation in so many ways, quite positive. And then when they took on the role of parent, ironically, they began to question authority on behalf of their kids, which, this is the ironic point, mm-hmm. undercut their own kids' ability to advocate for themselves, okay? I'm Gen X. I'm the next generation, right? I'm latchkey. But the members of my generation, we just continued parenting the way, quote unquote, everyone in our communities, led by the baby boom parents, were already parenting. So there's definitely a pendulum shift, you know, toward this, you know, our kids are helpless. Our kids need our help constantly as a result. We parents must advocate for them, go to bat for them, argue with every principal, coach, referee, and teacher. You know, we've got the best of intentions, but all we're teaching our kids is that we'll always be there to do it for them. And oh, by the way, the insidious message is, hey, kid, you're not actually capable of doing any of this without me.
Right. That's the message they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
But and you mentioned, you know, the Gen X, the latchkey kids, and maybe we're reacting to the childhood, you know, we had. But there's also, I mean, it does seem to coincide with a time when people are just working a lot more, two parents working, you know, work has become more, you know, intrusive on our time, that with the little time we have, we hold our kids close. We want to, I mean, these are also, you know, you kind of point out that parents and there are sort of less disagreements with parents. The parents and kids are kind of getting along better than they used to, and that is sort of contributing to the problem. I just wonder, a lot of issues there, but,
yes.
You know, are we... You know, we're just kind of trying to enjoy our kids, too.
As
right?
Well we should. Uh-huh. Our kids are our precious, precious children. And if mine are listening, I hope they're smiling as they hear me say this. I love them. You love yours. We all love our children. And isn't it wonderful that relationships between parents and kids today are so much more emotionally close than was the case when I was growing up and previous generations were. So, hey, I'm not against closeness. Mm-hmm. I'm not in any way against a college student, you know, checking in with family to say, hey, guys, how are you doing? You know, what's going on? You know, how's life? How's my little brother or sister? What I'm worried about is when that college student feels their only mode of support is a phone call or a text away to a parent when they essentially have not done enough of the doing, the making, the thinking, the being in their own lives such that they really feel they can't rely upon themselves to do the work of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's not about not – of course we love. Of course we hold. Of course we want the very best for them. What we've got to appreciate is that it is most loving – to teach our kids the skills they're gonna need, the life skills, the way to take responsibility, accountability, to take the initiative, to think outside the box. You know, when we do all the deciding for them, they don't develop those skills. Then they end up out in the world of work lacking the capabilities their boss is going to need. And hey, their boss isn't going to focus on their self-esteem first. Their boss cares about the bottom line. So it's loving to actually teach them to do for themselves.
So part of this message seems to be a little bit about parents being more adult in sort of an old-fashioned way. Chores, making kids do things around the house. You don't do things for them. Sort of trying not having to be their friend all the time and really being authoritative.
Correct. So according to those who are expert in this realm, either from a sociological or psychological perspective, there are four types of parenting, and they really play out according to a quadrant that measures the degree of demands they place on kids and the degree of responsiveness they have to their kids. You know, an authoritarian parent, the sort of tiger mom, quote unquote, if you will, that harsh approach to I have high demands and you will carry them out. And I'm not at all concerned about your feelings or how any of this, is making you feel. Authoritarian is high demand, low responsive. Permissive is no demand, high responsive. This is permissive / indulgent. These are parents who just want to do everything for their kids and do not hold them accountable. There's negligent, which is no demands and not responsive. What we want to be is in the fourth quadrant, high demands of our kids and highly responsive to their needs. That's authoritative parenting. And that's where we need to be.
Okay. So you have how-tos and I mentioned chores. Chores is kind of a big part of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Absolutely. And believe me, I was mortified to discover when my kids were about 8 and 10 that they weren't doing any. Mm-hmm. You know, classic example of what you just said. We're so busy. You know, my husband and I both work outside the home. You know, when we're with our kids, we want to kind of make life nice and easy for them. That was our mindset, I think, when they were young. You know, I just finished having a, you know, dinner time conversation with parents of freshmen who had just come to campus. So it's the first day of orientation. There's a big talk to parents about trust your kid, trust the university. Now, please go home. Ha ha. You know, loving, compassionate conversation, but trying to send the message, it's time for you to step back. The next day I go home, I'm having dinner in my own house with my own kids. They're 8 and 10. And I reach over and I'm cutting my 10-year-old's meat. And that's when I realized, Judy, okay, I'm now part of the problem. I can see if I don't think ahead, you know, when do they cut their own meat? When do they cross the street? When do I let them talk to strangers? If I don't intentionally think about these things, if I stand in the way of them developing those skills, I will be that parent whose kid is 18 and still needs me, you know, for the reminder about, do you need a coat? Did you tie your shoes? Is your homework in your backpack? You know, don't forget to do this or that. I mean, I don't want to be that parent. I have compassion for those parents.
It's the easiest way to do it, though, isn't it? It can be simpler.
You know, it can be simpler because we can do it more quickly, whatever the task is. You know, empty the dishwasher. I guarantee you and I can do that more quickly than, you know, your kids can at their young age. And my kids can, perhaps even as teenagers. But how will they ever learn if we're always doing it? They won't.
But the kids you were seeing at Stanford, I mean, we're talking about the elite of the elite, right? I mean, these are kids who did fantastic in school. And, you know, a lot of people, people have 3-5 hours of homework a day. I mean, how is it that we're supposed to, adding chores to that, where are the hours in the day for all this? And they're doing tons of extracurricular activities.
So for some reason, we value the 3 to 5 hours of homework and all of the activities over building the life skills that come from doing chores. We also value the homework and the activities over sleep, which pediatricians are increasingly reporting in rather alarming tones is detrimental to our kids' growth and development. So if we as parents can accept, you know, our teenagers need 8.5 to 9.25 hours of sleep a night, and we're, you know, hell-bent on making sure they get that sleep, why can we not also appreciate, and they need to take out the garbage, and they need to feed the pet, and they need to know how to do laundry? You know, it's not, we're under-preparing them for success in life. If all we do is cultivate their academic accomplishments, and they end up out in the world with a great transcript and a GPA, but they can't do for themselves, and they're going to need us to be their assistant or their concierge for the rest of their lives.
But aren't schools like Stanford part of the problem? I mean, we're asking kids to be everything.
You know, I think schools like Stanford are not part of the problem. They don't make parents overparent. But schools like Stanford, I think, can be part of the solution. I think, you know, what it takes today to get into a top-tier college is simply so much more than it took in the 1980s when I was applying. And yet kids are still adolescents applying, and they're still only 168 hours in a week. You know, we ask so much more of them by way of APs, the number of APs, the number of activities, you know, to get the highest possible GPA, the highest possible SAT or ACT, which means studying for the test a zillion times and taking it a number of times. You know, I think what the colleges and universities can do is signal, hey, we don't want you to mortgage your childhood. Yeah, we want to know you're hardworking, you know, that you're motivated, that you're curious, but we're not asking you to mortgage your childhood. And I think they can tweak the admission process in whatever way makes sense for each institution to signal that and then to really stand by that in terms of how they admit.
But that pressure is just coming, you know, down. I mean, you know, you to people concerned about what school they're going to while they're pregnant, you know, plotting out the academic trajectory of their children. But I want to talk to you, too, about you have children. You write about this. You have children at Gunn High School in Palo Alto, which, you know, has been going through a tragic situation lately with suicides. And, you know, while it would be irresponsible to say we know the cause of suicide, that is a pressure cooker. These kids, there's a lot of mental health problems at schools like this. Talk about, you know, what that is, what you see at Gunn.
You know, I love Gunn High School, and my kids are proud to be Gunn Titans, and I think the administration there is fantastic. And that's my high school right down this, my kids' high school right down the street. In the face of this devastating tragedy, set of tragedies, I continue to do a lot of thinking about not simply the terrible number of kids who will try or succeed at taking their lives, but the far greater number of kids beneath them who are experiencing a fairly backbreaking amount of pressure, and the kids underneath them who are feeling, you know, some degree of, will this ever be worth it? You know, they are on this academic treadmill, and we've narrowed success, the definition of success in our community, in our nation, you know, in communities like mine, certainly, you know, is a sense that you've got to get into one of these top tier schools, you know, and have a singular notable achievement by the time you're 17 in order to matter in life. And that's one of the worst messages we can send to young people. And here's what I will stand up and say on your radio station and in my town in Palo Alto. You know, the Stanfords and Harvards and Yales and Princetons of the world are lovely, wonderful schools. You can get a great education. But a great education is to be had at a couple hundred schools in our nation, small liberal arts colleges, big public universities, community colleges, okay? We have to widen our blinders.
We're talking with former Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford University, Julie Lithcott-Hames, about her new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kids for Success. Are you a parent? Do you struggle with these questions? A teacher or the parents in your class too involved? Not involved enough? If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Judy Campbell. You're listening to KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, and we're talking about how to stop overparenting with Julie Lithcott-Hames, author of How to Raise an Adult. So we were talking about colleges as we went to the break, and we will talk a little more about that. First, I'd love to get to the idea of, you know, we are talking about middle and upper class parents. How do we see this playing out? Is this something that cuts across classes or the issues? Is this drifting into other classes as well?
Well, I think the answer is that if you're a parent that's poor, if you're a parent that's working class, you're working, you know, however many jobs you need to keep a roof over your family's head and put food on the table. This endemic around hovering, this over-involvement in the lives of kids, therefore, is something parents can only do if they've got a little extra time and income on their hands. So, you know, what people have asked me, you know, where do you see this? Do you see it more in certain ethnic communities, certain racial communities? I've seen it across racial and ethnic demographics, but when it comes to class, that's where the divide is. And the great irony, I keep speaking about ironies on this show, but here's another one. Kids who grow up in working class families are going to develop a set of life skills by dint of their life experience that their more affluent peers will lack. So if those poorer kids have a decent mentor, have access to a good education, they will emerge as adults with a sort of grit and resilience, these buzzwords we care about, skills needed in the workplace, such that they'll be more likely to thrive, I think, than their more pampered, coddled, affluent peers.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you as freshman dean, probably those are the kids you're supposed to be watching out for, right? The ones who maybe you're the first in their family to go to college and don't have sort of them. We hear a lot about kids like that not making it through school. You're having the experience where those people in a lot of ways are better prepared.
Well, you know, differently prepared. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. When I began my role as dean in 2002, and I created the role at Stanford, I was the first to hold it. I thought it was a good idea. And I thought we could be even more effective at bringing our newest undergraduates into the university community. And I presumed that the 15% of our students who were first-generation college students, for example, might need a little bit more of a watchful eye of a dean who would pay attention to their experience. You know, kids from those backgrounds certainly face challenges, you know, when their life experience confronts what Stanford expects of them. But those weren't the students who needed me the most in many ways. It was their more affluent peers who were accustomed to having mom or dad make the decisions, solve the problems, contend with authority, soothe their feelings, who found themselves kind of bewildered in a very competitive context where, you know, fast-moving, competitive, you know, where they found themselves sort of not familiar enough with their own selves to know kind of how to do for themselves.
A listener writes online, this is not just a problem at the Ivies. As a graduate TA at a major UC, we were stunned with 21-year-olds threatening to tell their parents if they got an A- or B- as a final grade. We even had a couple of those vicious, histrionic emails printed for entertainment purposes, but it's really not that funny. It's tragic that teaching at any level now comes with the associated risk of your job and livelihood being threatened by the children and adults you're trying to help.
Well, absolutely. This listener is right on. And I think I said at the top of the hour that this is by no means a Stanford problem. I was just seeing, and my colleagues at Stanford were just seeing, what administrators and faculty are seeing in every tier, in every part of this nation. There's something about childhood in America today, and quite frankly, in a number of other countries, that that means parents are right there by your side. You know, it's not just the kids who end up being admitted to a place like Stanford or a UC. You know, it's kids at every school and in every tier.
And beyond school, I mean, there are kids. I was shocked to read in your book that parents are showing up for job interviews with kids.
Yeah. And, you know, there's really no better way to say my kid is unqualified for this job than to stand there with them, prepping them for their interview, coaching them on what to say. And I think one of the employers I interviewed said, you know, clearly this mother didn't realize we could overhear her in the foyer. But, you know, it was a big red mark on that candidate's application. It was a candidate to be an EMT, you know, to ride around in the back of an ambulance, where you need to know how to think on your feet, solve problems, take the initiative, and you can't call your mom to say, how do I perform CPR?
Mm-hmm. Online Sue writes, the colleges are not without blame. When we sent our daughter off to college in Canada from the Bay Area by herself, she was fine, but she did feel inadequate because everyone else's parents were there opening week with many activities planned by the college for only the students, but the parents. It's ridiculous.
Well, I think what this listener is speaking to is the fact that some colleges and universities have decided to really embrace this phenomenon of parents wanting to play a role and be present in the life of the university or college. Many others continue to keep a respectful distance, to say, you know what, it's your son's or daughter's college experience. Please, you know, trust that we know what we're doing and that they are capable of advocating for themselves, of listening at the info sessions, you know, of paying attention, of – you know, keeping track of what they'll want to do. So, you know, to the parent who's feeling excluded or whose kid feels less than because, you know, everyone else's parent is there, I would say, you know, inculcate in your kid a pride that they're able to do and be for themselves. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do with my own. You know, it's, hey, I don't need to be there for you at sixth grade registration. Mm-hmm. You're capable. I want them to feel proud of that, not to feel that I've somehow neglected them by not accompanying
them. And you have your children tell you what of their activities, what performances you need to go to. You don't have to go to every soccer game.
Exactly. My daughter's a dancer and dances, you know, 6 days a week. And there are conventions and competitions. And I am proud of her. I love to watch her. But I have other stuff going on in my life. So I can't just watch my daughter all the time, or my son for that matter. I've got my own stuff. So I ask her, which one's important? I will be there. And she knows my heart is bursting wide open with joy and pride. But I'm not going to be one of those people who just accompanies my kid everywhere and stands on the sidelines of their lives.
Let's hear from our listeners. Anne and Katati, join us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And this is a very good talk. I am both the parent of a very recent Stanford grad, but I also help students apply to college. And many of the things you say, when I see parents who want to attend every meeting, who I think are really writing their children's essays for them, it's very sad. What parents do not always realize is that where their child goes to college does not affect the child's outcome of success as how well they do in college and finding a place that fits and where they're going to be successful because they feel successful and that they can do it instead of going somewhere that they're overwhelmed.
Thanks for that comment.
I couldn't agree more. And thanks for the work that you're doing. We need more and more people like you in this work of helping kids understand how to apply for college, who appreciate that the kid has to be at the forefront of that experience. And to your points, yes, where a kid finds fit and belonging on a college campus is essential. It's not the brand name that's going to make or break those 4 years for them. It's how they do there. It's whether they'll feel like they can be themselves, be challenged, and thrive. So a sense of fit and belonging is the most essential factor. And then, as Malcolm Gladwell has said, there's actually a utilitarian, and I write about this in the book, there's this really utilitarian benefit of going to a place that may be a little bit less well-known, not as selective, where you can have confidence you're going to be in the top 10% there rather than go to one of the bigger brand names where you might be in the bottom half.
Don't go to the best school you're admitted to.
Right? It's the big fish, small pond theory. Mm-hmm. You want to go where you know you're going to have access to the greatest number of goodies, you know, attention from faculty, opportunities to do research. You know, you're going to get the attention. That means you're going to emerge from that undergraduate experience really knowing your subject, really connected to experts, you know, with great letters of recommendation. I mean, that's what opens the door to the first job or to graduate school. People think that brand name follows you around or is sort of stamped on your forehead for the rest of your life, but it's not. It might be enough of a bias to get you your first job, but it won't help you keep your first job if you don't have the skills that are needed, you know, and it's not going to really help you get your second or third job. And Laszlo Bock says this at Google, you know, it's not where people go to school. It's the skills they have.
You know, I wonder, millennials have been skewered in the press and they're the battered generation from, you know, the narcissism, entitlement, all of these things. I just wonder kind of your take on some of this. I mean, I know your blame in this book falls on the parents. But what do you think of sort of the way we talk and think about millennials? Do we have them right?
We don't have them right. You know, I worked with millennials. I worked with thousands of millennials. They are amazing humans. They want to work hard. They want to make a contribution. They're incredible. And they're the biggest generation in our nation's history. They've eclipsed their own parents now, the baby boom. So, you know, we love millennials, and it's a good thing because we've got them. They're going to be leading this nation before long. Boy, don't we want them to have the skills they're going to need, not only to just sort of be okay, but to thrive, you know, to really take the mantle of leadership from those among us who have it best right now and lead us out into the 21st century? Yes, we do. So if they're narcissistic, if they're entitled, my goodness, they were raised that way. We've got to turn it around. You know, we've got to help them understand. There's a great person in the book, Nancy Altobello. She works at Ernst & Young, you know, and Nancy, she's the HR, head of talent for Ernst & Young. And she says, I've figured out how to work with millennials. And now that I know how to work with them, which is to be very clear about what I'm expecting, very clear about how their work fits into the context of the larger They might want a mentor. Fantastic. I'll do all those things for them. If I do what they need, I get greater output from them than any other generation. So there's a real plug for millennials. You know, they're not hopeless, hapless, helpless, but their childhood has undercut their chances, you know, to really be what the workplace needs. It's on us now to mentor and guide them, you know, out of their quarter life crisis.
Mary Kelly joins us from Piedmont. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just want to push back a little because, you know, I have two teenagers and I've seen a lot of kids apply to college. And I really think, for me, this is an institutional problem. It really does. And for, in my experience, my humble experience, I think Stanford is the worst at actually what recruiting elite, the kind of elite performers, especially in athletics, that in order to perform at that level, at that age, at the age of 16, you've got to have a deeply compromised childhood. And I think that you have, you know, Denise Pope at Stanford says the same thing. And yet at the acceptance, at the admissions level, I really don't think there's any effort at the institutional level to vet candidates for being normal people. They're like elite racehorses. And I would just, I mean, I think the proof is in the pudding. And I think if you go to University of Arizona, I think you, I mean, and I'm just, I don't know Arizona, but the point is, you know, Santa Clara, these kinds of schools, I think they actually have a way of attracting and advocating for much more normal people.
Right. So if Stanford was to base their admissions on a more kind of holistic view of kids, you know, looking for a real person, we wouldn't have this kind of pressure.
Well, Mary Kelly, with all due respect, I do disagree. You won't be surprised. Couple things. Number one, I'm on Denise Pope's board. She runs Challenge Success, an amazing organization in the Bay Area, really trying to get us to examine the ways in which we define success and the harm of defining it too narrowly and being overly focused on grades and scores and athletic achievements. So I agree wholeheartedly with Denise Pope and that organization. With respect to athletics, yeah, Stanford's got the best athletics Division I program in the nation 21 years in a row. You don't get there by not recruiting, you know, the top student athletes. But Stanford is a part of the NCAA along with, you know, hundreds of other schools. And I think this issue about the extent to which kids are recruited younger and younger than ever, you know, having to hyper-specialize younger and younger. I mean, that's not a Stanford issue. That's a problem in our nation right now. And I hope the people who run those organizations will take a look at what's right for youth in terms of their health, their mental health and physical health, and figure out, you know, how to turn that system, pivot that system toward, you know, great accomplishment, but also health and wellness. You know, and I have to say, having known so many Stanford students, boy, they are normal people in your sense of the word. Amazing young people. Admissions work so hard not to simply reward those who have been hyper-coached and handled, you know, by a third party or by a parent, but to find that actual kid who's actually done the work themselves and has the hunger with a curiosity within themselves around a particular topic. So, you know, and of course, yes, Santa Clara also has wonderful people. And University of Arizona, you know, the two other schools you mentioned, there are 2,800 four-year colleges and institutions in the United States that are accredited. And as with anything, I'd wager that the top 5% of them are worth a really strong look. They're probably magnificent. You know, that's 140 schools. So why are we hell-bent on our kids going to what the U.S. News and World Report tells us are the best? Let's widen our blinders, look at more schools. Most of them don't have an uber-competitive, highly selective admission rate. You know, you shouldn't have to feel like a failure for not getting into a college that admits 5 to 10%. You know, you should feel thrilled to go to a place that has admitted you, where you can feel the sense of belonging and fit.
Well, it does strike me that there are a lot of institutional problems that do pop up. I mean, one is, you know, it's you talked before about prioritizing the kid's life over homework. I mean, it's very hard as a parent to just say, don't do your homework, right? I mean, it's a little bit of a of a revolt.
You know, we do need a revolt. We need a revolt in communities where kids are routinely assigned. I mean, the national average, Judy, for homework, according to Challenge Success, the national average is in communities like ours, that, you know, affluent, college-bound communities, is 3 hours a night. Mm. And many of us in the Bay Area would laugh at that. Only three? Who's kidding who? You know? Five. We need a revolt. We need to cite the evidence that says, you know, after a certain point, homework not only is not valuable, there's a diminishing value, and it exacerbates stress. You know, let's change up our teaching pedagogies and approaches so that kids are actually learning. You know, homework isn't this repetitive bundle of stuff they just have to accomplish. Okay, we do need to revolt in our communities, on our school boards, in our parent-teacher associations, yes. But even if our community is crazy, we as parents have to remember we're in charge of what happens in our own house at what I call the local level of my kitchen counter and dining table. I get to say, you know what? This is too much. And I don't care that this is what's expected of you. Your sleep matters too. Your wellness matters too. And I, the parent, and we, the parents, have to be big enough to stand up to these forces and say, this is harming our kids. Okay? It's on us as parents not to be bullied by this pressure, but to say, you know what? I'm opting out. People move away. They choose different schools. They say to their kids, fine, you're going to get a B minus. That's okay. Because you got a smile on your face. You've worked hard. You've worked long enough. You're getting sleep. You're not always going to be perfect. And I love you anyway.
Julie writes, I am a parent of an incoming middle schooler in the Bay Area. And I'm curious about the guest position on cell phones for this 6th to 8th grade age range. Do cell phones allow more independence for the child, or just give parents one more way to stay too connected and overparent?
Well, you know, technology, technology, technology. People for years have said to me, isn't it the, you know, isn't technology to blame for overparenting? And my answer is no. And here's how I know. I was concerned about parents hovering over the lives of their kids way before parents and kids were texting each other every moment of every day. So to your question, Julie, about middle schoolers, my kids' middle school has a policy that cell phones are not allowed. I think it's great to, if you feel you need your kid to have one for that peace of mind that, you know, they're walking or biking to school, if they need you, they can text you to, you know, for something, fine. I think by middle school, you don't need to be texting them to say, did you make it to school? Are you at school? You know, we don't need, look, we need to only look so far back as our own middle school years to remember our parents were not in our ears. Okay. Our middle schoolers deserve a longer leash, more independence. Keep the cell phone if you need to deal with transportation snafus that might arise, but they do not need you to be interacting with them during the school day.
Tom in San Jose, join us. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I have a daughter who just finished her first year at the University of California. And I wanted to just chime in because, you know, both my wife and I are here in the Silicon Valley and very much in the technical workforce and in products and so forth. So we're in touch with our daughter on a daily basis when she's on campus, communicating with her via text, IM, you know, iPhone, everything. But what we're communicating with her about is really more about how to deal with interactions that you and I as adults take for granted. We're not hovering over whether she wakes up on time. We're hovering over the complex conversations like, well, I went to my, you know, my TA and she was busy. But I couldn't get her attention. So, you know, teaching her how to be more advanced in interpersonal communication, getting what she needs, that assistance that you learn over the years, we're trying to help her deal with now. And I think what it comes down to is the rate of maturity. Not every child matures just the day they graduate from high school. It's an ongoing process that, frankly, some people never mature, but, you know, it takes time. And I think there's we heard it from the University of California as well. Drop your daughter off. She's safe. Well, yeah, everything's great, but she doesn't quite have the advanced skills yet to be a completely, effective adult.
Right. Tom, I completely hear you, and I want to applaud you for not calling the TA yourself. What you're doing is you're teaching your daughter to do for herself, and there are actually, you know, four steps that I've learned from actually from parents of special needs kids who have to be more deliberate about inculcating life skills than parents of typically developing kids. kids have to, because their disability might otherwise, you know, get in the way and impede the skill development. So this four-step process that I learned from my friend Stacey Ashland is, number one, first you do it for them. Number two, then you do it with them. Number three, then you watch them do it. And number four, then they do it entirely themselves. And I think with your daughter and this question about, you know, how do I get the TA's attention? The TA was busy. Here, you know, you're giving her advice by text or by phone. You're sort of in that in between stages two and three, some combination of the two. You're sort of watching. You're doing it with her and hopefully watching her do it. But, you know, I think the larger point is you're right. They don't become mature on their 18th birthday. Childhood is meant to prepare for that inevitable day. So if we can look for ways to inculcate these skills in our 8-year-old, in our 10-year-old, in our 14-year-old, they will become that freshman in college who knows, yeah, the TA might be busy. How do I respectfully, you know, advocate for myself and have the conversation that I need to?
Here's Stephen tweets, how hard should parents push kids in any pursuit? Should I don't want to go to piano, baseball, tutoring mean the end?
I don't want to go to baseball, piano, whatever, shouldn't be the end. But I'm not interested in this anymore. I really don't like it. Should be a signal parents pay attention to. You know, there are two athletes who come to mind when parents ask me this question. One is Andre Agassi. The other is Jeremy Lin. And Agassi rose to the highest heights of tennis and apparently hated a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. And he did it because his dad made him. Was he skilled? Undoubtedly. But he didn't feel a sense of joy or purpose in doing it. So he's got these trophies. But boy, does he seem to have been an unhappy human during it. It really gets to the larger question of what do we want for them? What's success? Jeremy Lin, on the other hand, the improbably tall child of his parents who loved basketball, you know, they supported that seemingly crazy idea. And he played and he didn't get, you know, a scholarship out of high school and he didn't get drafted early on. And, you know, and yet they supported that. You know, so what I'm getting at is the child's actual interest, you know, plus a sense that they have skill is what should drive it, as opposed to, oh, my goodness, the world, you know, needs them to be a this, that or the other, or I want them to be a this, that or the other, or they have a skill, it looks like, for this, that and the other. If they're lacking the underlying motivation, they will not be as good at it as they might otherwise be. They certainly won't enjoy it and they won't feel good about their lives or the fact that you pushed them in that direction.
Amy calls from San Jose. Hi.
Hi, this, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm very interested in this topic, both as a parent, a sociologist, and a professor. I actually have been teaching for 10 years down the road from Stanford at San Jose State. And I just wanted to offer a little bit of a different perspective. Most of my students are working class students, and a lot of them are first generation students. And to some extent, I actually see disadvantages for them regarding the fact that their parents haven't been super involved in the ways that we've been talking about.
Right.
I totally agree that they are a lot more resilient. They have, if for lack of a better word, street smart. But they don't often have the ability to navigate social institutions at all because they haven't really acquired that. They often don't have the resume or the skills to, for example, even have any help applying for colleges. Some of my students had no idea that they could have applied for scholarships, that they had the grades to actually apply for better schools. They don't know how to apply for graduate schools. And a school like San Jose State, where I think students can certainly get a good education, we're not as resourced as a school like Stanford. So we actually can't provide them with the level of assistance institutionally. And if they don't have parents doing that, it really puts them at a disadvantage. There's a sociologist, Annette Leroux, who actually talks about this, the fact that she calls it cultural capital, that some of these students who, and I'm certainly not advocating for helicopter parenting, but I've never had a student parent ever call me in the 10 years that I've been
right.
there.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I think that the students who do have those parents advocating for them, it you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Right.
Maybe that helps them to some extent. And my students don't have that.
Right. So, Amy, thank you. It's such an important point. I'm so glad you called with that.
Yeah, Amy, thanks. Yeah, Annette Leroux has talked about cultural capital, and she's absolutely right, and so are you. That's why I was very interested in mentoring the students on my campus who are first generation or from poor or working class backgrounds where their parents may not have the familiarity with, you know, the college milieu and would need help navigating and negotiating. But Annette Leroux also spoke about concerted cultivation, which is what we're doing in middle and upper middle class communities to sort of carefully cultivate our kids to lead these perfect lives. And those kids are underserved too. So yes, it's, you know, a kid benefits when a parent knows what's going on and can teach them. And poor and working class kids, you know, need help in that regard. If their parents don't have that mindset, that capability, they need mentors, you know, professors like you who can pay attention to that and care about that. But it doesn't mean that, you know, their more advantaged peers aren't also suffering in this and differently so. And I really want to be careful to use that word. But, you know, undercut in their chances to advocate for themselves, think for themselves, you know, solve their own problems. You know, they're going to need those skills, too.
Very short on time, but let's get Tricia in San Francisco writes, okay, so parents have done too much. If so, kids grown and too attached, what to do when they are dependent? What to do with young adults who will not show up or advocate to do for themselves? How to address this with kids who are already grown, older teens, early 20s?
Yeah. You know, I predict that therapist couches are going to be full with millennials turned 30 to 40-year-olds who are grappling with, my goodness, you know, how did I manage to get this chronologically adult and, you know, really not know how to live a life, earn money, make my way, hold down relationships and jobs and so on. I feel for you, and I think it's time for a serious conversation, owning up to our own failures as parents. Like, look, we inadvertently we did too much and ended up undercutting your ability to do for yourself. Let's acknowledge that. Let's look it in the face and figure out, okay, so now what? What are we going to do from here? We're going to stop saying we when we mean our sons or daughters. We're going to stop making all those phone calls for you. You know, we're going to stop doing your work for you. We're going to teach you how to do these things for yourself.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean and freshman and undergraduate advisory at Stanford University, author of How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap, and Prepare Your Kids for Success. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Judy. I'll be at the Commonwealth Club.
And you will be at the Commonwealth Club.
July 20th at the Commonwealth Club. Would love to see your listeners there.
Well, thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.